KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Pope Francis has died. The first Latin American pope led the worldwide Catholic Church for 12 years, and he brought a tone of humility to an exalted position. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. International correspondent Ruth Sherlock is on the ground in Italy. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In this hour, we will place calls around the world to hear reactions to the Pope's death. His supporters said that he re-energized the church. The leader of a conservative institution was seen by some as liberal. What did he say about the environment and capitalism and more? And how much did he really change a church with more than 2,000 years of history? We have much to discuss on this morning after his final public appearance, which was on Easter Sunday. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Vatican says the body of Pope Francis will be placed in a coffin today in a ceremony at the chapel of the hotel where he lived. The Pope died today at the age of 88. NPR's Silvio Pujoli reports.
Jorge Maria Bergoglio was born in Buenos Aires, the son of Italian immigrants. He was the first Jesuit to become pope, the first to take the name of St. Francis of Assisi, and the first pope from the Global South. Francis was beloved for his common touch and his vision of a merciful and inclusive church. He described it as a field hospital after battle, healing the wounds of the faithful and going out to find those who have been hurt, excluded, or fallen away. A firm believer in the need to save the planet, Francis was not afraid to criticize Western societies for what he called their unfettered pursuit of money. He also made many enemies within the church for his efforts to reform and clean up the Vatican bureaucracy. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
After reports, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared detailed plans about a military operation in a second Signal group chat. The White House is standing by him. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says President Trump has confidence in Hegseth and stands behind the Defense Secretary. Reports surfaced Sunday that Hegseth had shared information about a U.S. military strike in Yemen in a chat on the platform Signal. The chat included people like his wife and brother and was on the secretary's personal phone. It comes just weeks after the White House confirmed reporting of a different Signal group chat talking about the strike with multiple officials like National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Hegseth himself spoke to reporters Monday at the White House Easter egg roll and attacked the media for the reporting and blamed the narrative on, quote, a few leakers who were fired from their government jobs. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
An Israeli military investigation has determined the killing of 15 Palestinian medics and emergency workers in Gaza was the result of professional failures. Their bodies were buried in a mass grave and their ambulances were crushed. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
The military's rare admission of failures in Gaza came after phone video found on one of the paramedics' bodies became public, disproving the Israeli military's initial claims around the incidents. The military had said the emergency vehicles did not have flashing lights on, which was proven untrue by the video. The subsequent military investigation determined the killings were a result of, quote, operational misunderstanding, prompting the dismissal of a deputy commander. The head of the UN's operations in Gaza, Jonathan Woodall, says some of the findings continue to contradict the evidence and urged greater accountability. The Palestinian Red Crescent has called for an independent investigation and says the killing of its paramedics in March reflects a dangerous pattern. Local officials in Gaza say nearly 140 rescue workers and medics have been killed by Israel in the war while on the job. Aya Beltraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 900 points. This is NPR. The UN says Pakistan has pushed out nearly a million Afghans from the country since Pakistan stepped up deportations in September 2023. Deportations have risen just this month. NPR's Dia Hadid reports Pakistan has given hundreds of thousands of Afghans a deadline to leave.
A Pakistani official told the Reuters news agency that some 80,000 Afghans were deported this month, while the UN says that in total, more than 854,000 Afghans have left. The UN says those Afghans left either because they were deported or because they feared deportation. Some of them are Afghan families who fled to neighboring Pakistan so their daughters can attend school. The Taliban, which rules Afghanistan, does not allow girls to study beyond grade 6. But there's been growing hostility against Afghans in Pakistan. That's partly as Pakistani officials blame the Afghan Taliban for harbouring militants who've been conducting increasingly brazen attacks in the country. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
The gunman who shot and killed 23 people in a racist attack in El Paso, Texas in 2019 will appear in a state court today. Patrick Crucius is expected to accept a plea deal and admit he intentionally targeted Latino shoppers at a Walmart. In exchange, he would avoid the death penalty for a life prison term without parole. The first winners have crossed the finish line at the Boston Marathon. The winner of the men's wheelchair division is Marcel Hug of Switzerland, who's won this for the eighth time. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
A dramatic Monday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Pope Francis has died. He was 88 years old. To discuss the latest updates as tributes come pouring in from around the world, NPR international correspondent Ruth Sherlock and religion correspondent Jason DeRose join us now. Ruth, let's start with you. The Pope had been unwell. But it looked like he was on his way back, coming back, making a complete recovery. His announcement of this death, though, comes very suddenly. What can you tell us about what happened?
Well, that's right. I mean, he was suffering from chronic lung disease, double pneumonia, and it was had been in critical condition a few weeks ago. He was hospitalized for about 5 weeks, the longest hospitalization of his papacy. And at the time, there were these nightly prayers for Saint Francis, Pope Francis in St. Peter's Square. But then he made this recovery. He came out of hospital and had been convalescing and even starting to make public appearances. But he passed away at 7:35 this morning. The Vatican's Cardinal Kevin Farrell made the announcement. He said, "The Bishop of Rome, Francis, returned to the house of the Father. His entire life was dedicated to the service of the Lord and his church."
Now, what are we hearing from people at St. Peter's Square at the Vatican?
Well, as you can imagine, you know, people are gathering and they're starting to speak about how they want to remember Francis. Here's Regina Adams Hall from Atlanta, Georgia.
I think it's so important that his last words were peace and about humanity and how we treat one another. And it's so important because he was an old man and he knew he was a dying old man. And I think his words are so important. And that we should heed those words.
She's referring there to the fact that he appeared at Easter Mass yesterday and had somebody read out his speech. And in that speech, that last speech, he spoke about people being wounded in conflict, in particular the conflict between Israel and Gaza, the endless outbursts of violence there. And his words called on the international community to act, to come to the aid of a starving people who aspire, that aspires to a future of peace. And that is so central to the message that he has repeated throughout his papacy, trying to champion the poor and those suffering in conflict.
Now, Jason, you've covered Pope Francis for years. What are some of the moments of his papacy that you think will stick most with you?
Well, as Ruth said, his concern for the poor, or you know, the least of these in the world, I think a very important issue for Pope Francis was refugees, migrants, and immigration. You know, early in his papacy, he took a couple of papal trips, one to Lampedusa to highlight the plight of refugees in North Africa, and shortly thereafter, he went to Lesbos, an island in the Mediterranean, to highlight refugees from the Middle East. And he talked about refugees having this special place in the heart of God. And he constantly referred to the biblical story of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph having to flee Bethlehem shortly after Jesus' birth because King Herod wanted to kill Jesus. He said, you know, the Holy Family were refugees too, and that means they are very important to God. And he, in fact, said that migration should be, and immigration should be, an important issue in the most recent U.S. election, when U.S. bishops were very interested in focusing on abortion. Francis said, also pay attention to what the candidates say about migration and refugees. So again, and this was all part of his understanding that these are really the poorest people, the people in the greatest need, and so they are the people that the church should pay the closest attention to.
What do you think his legacy as Pope will be here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the environment will be very important. You know, his first solo encyclical as Pope focused on the environment, care for creation, which God created as good. He also focused on the environment, again, getting back to that idea of the poor, because environmental degradation weighs very heavily on the poor. Desertification and flooding and famine and poverty all go hand in hand, and that leads to that global migrant crisis that he talked about. So it was a really holistic understanding of what his issues were. Some other issues that I think will be key to him: there was a lot of talk about whether women would become deacons while he was Pope. That did not end up happening, after all. After a couple of very large meetings, that conversation was tabled. Another big area of concern for the Pope was the treatment of LGBTQ people. He thought it was very important to talk about them as beloved children of God. Although I will point out, you know, he made some big changes, or he okayed some changes. He said that priests could bless people in same-sex relationships, but he didn't change the core teaching of the church, is that same-sex sexual attraction is intrinsically disordered and is in fact a sin. So there were some big changes, but not as much as some of the more progressive parts of the church would want.
Ruth, back to you quickly. What are the plans for his funeral?
Well, this will happen in 4 to 5 days' time, and Pope Francis has tried to strip away a lot of the pomp from his papacy, both in life and also in death. He's asking for a simpler casket. Popes were traditionally buried in 3 nested coffins. He's asking for 1 made of wood and lined in zinc. He's previously said, you know, that the Roman pontiff's funeral should be that of a shepherd and the disciple of Christ, and not a powerful man of this world.
All right, that's NPR international correspondent Ruth Sherlock and religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, Ruth, thank you.
You're welcome.
Cardinal Blaise Supich joins us next. He is the Archbishop of Chicago, appointed by Francis. He's also a member of the College of Cardinals, the group that will soon help to elect the next Pope. Cardinal Supich, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's so many people, because Pope Francis continued meeting people until the last day of his life. There are people who today are able to say, I saw him just yesterday. I saw him on Easter Sunday. You must have seen him a number of times over the years. When did you last speak with Francis, and what was it like to be with him?
Well, I was at a meeting in which he gathered with a number of us in November, and it was a brief conversation I had with him, but that was the last time that I had any kind of exchange with him.
And what was he like to deal with?
Well, he was always very sharp and with his mind. He was very incisive in his thought. He asked penetrating questions and always with a good sense of humor. He always looked for an opportunity to put people at ease with with that humor of his.
I suppose his very overt humility must also have helped to put people at ease when meeting somebody in such an exalted position.
Well, he could do some serious things, but never took himself seriously.
I want to pick up on something that we heard there from Jason DeRose, our religion correspondent. He said that Francis did not change the core teaching of the church, but at the same time, it does seem that he changed the tone. He brought his own tone to the job and also the personnel, and I guess you're an example of that. He elevated so many people. How different is the church than it was 12 years ago?
Well, I think what he wanted to do was to bring forward the inspiration of the Second Vatican Council and put it into practice. But a core aspect of his ministry really is rooted in the gospel, and that is the gospel of the mercy that God gives us and offers us. He pointed out that Jesus always took the first step to go after people, and that's how the church should work as well. We should be a field hospital, making sure that we're going out to people to offer them the care and the mercy of God.
What does that mean for people who are not clerics, people in their daily lives?
Well, I think it's rooted in an understanding that he had of himself, that he was chosen to take on the role that he did in the life of the church as an ordained person because he himself experienced the mercy of God. And he wanted everybody else to also have that experience so that they would show mercy to one another. Our world is a lot better off when we cut each other a little bit of slack, when we give another person another chance, when we show mercy. So many of the conflicts in the world and in our own families can be overcome if we follow that way of that he offered to us.
Now, Cardinal Supich is of course very early, but the Pope was 88, was in poor health, so people had time to think about what came next. What are you and other cardinals looking for in the next Pope?
Well, I think it's probably too early to even give thought to that because a lot of us are in a moment of mourning and grieving. We surely want to make sure that the important initiatives that he made are carried on. Again, it's because of what took place in the Second Vatican Council. But right now, I think we're focusing on comforting the people as they mourn the loss of the Holy Father.
When you say the Second Vatican Council, of course, you're talking about a moment in recent history when the Church tried to open up a little bit or was seen as trying to open up a little bit and following up on that in more recent years. Talk me through the process then. What should we expect over the next few days with the funeral and the next few weeks with the papal conclave? What happens when?
Well, the funeral ordinarily takes anywhere between 4 and 6 days after the death of the Pope. And then there is a 9-day period of mourning. After that, I guess we will get instructions from the Camerlingo, which is Cardinal Farrell, an American, who will be, in fact, running things as we go into the conclave. Since it's my first time, I'm really not sure exactly what all the dynamics are, and I'm just going to listen very attentively.
I'm told that so many of you are new that many of you will be meeting each other for the first time when that conclave begins. Does that sound right to you?
Well, we did have, the Pope did call us together as cardinals during one of the consistories about 2 or 3 years ago. So we did have the opportunity to get to know each other.
The final thing in a few seconds, how will you be remembering the Pope in Chicago?
Well, I think I'll be remembering him as an individual who transformed the life of the church in bringing the gospel of mercy back to the center of what we should be doing.
Cardinal Blaise Supich is the Archbishop of Chicago and a member of the College of Cardinals. Cardinal Supich, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And we'll continue covering the death of Pope Francis. That death was announced by the Vatican earlier today. This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Noah Wiley of the popular TV series The Pitt about drama and chaos in a Pittsburgh hospital emergency room. The show has earned a following among ER doctors for the accuracy of its portrayals of emergency medicine. Wiley plays a veteran doctor plagued by PTSD from the early days of COVID. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's what we can expect in Rome in the next few hours and days after the death of Pope Francis. We're told his body will be placed in a coffin at 8 o'clock tonight, Rome time. That's 2 o'clock Eastern time in the United States. The Pope's family and several senior Vatican officials will take part in the rite. Funeral comes in a few days. The papal conclave to choose a new leader comes after that. We spoke earlier with Father Tim Kosicki to get his thoughts. He's the former head of the Jesuit Conference of Canada in the United States.
Well, I was a little surprised because we thought he was going to die over a month ago, and he had made an appearance in St. Peter's Square for Easter Sunday. But also, I think Easter's a beautiful time to die. We knew he was near death, and so it comes as both a relief so that he's no longer carrying all of this burden, and the completion of 12 years as Pope.
12 quite dramatic years. It seems to me that he struck a different tone than other popes, but how much do you think he really changed the church over that time?
Yes, he clearly was a pastor, and that was his impulse, was always to be a pastoral. His change on the church we're going to see in the next really 5 to 10 years when we look at how future the next pope and future bishops follow his lead and example. I know that he will be remembered, live on in many people's hearts, and I'm eager to see how we continue much of his message.
Oh, now this is an interesting thing that you point out when you talk about the future, because I was reading that the Pope appointed something north of 150 cardinals during his time. Would these be people who bore to some extent his personal stamp and his approach to the church and to God and to the world?
I would say certainly he chose people, he preferred people who had strong pastoral instincts, but he also wanted to broaden the College of Cardinals to include representatives from all over the world. He had a first from Tonga, for example, and many other countries that had never had a cardinal. And so I think you're going to see two things, both that pastoral focus, but also a greater global representation when they meet to elect the next pope.
If you're just joining us, we are covering the death of Pope Francis, who has died at the age of 88, according to the Vatican, and we're talking with Father Tim Kosicki, who's a former head of the Jesuit Conference of Canada in the United States. And Father Kosicki, it's particularly interesting to talk with you because Francis was a Jesuit. He joined the Jesuit order in his early 20s. For those who are not familiar, who are the Jesuits? How are they different from anyone else? And how did you see Jesuit thinking, if at all, in Francis's papacy?
Yes, so he is the first Jesuit ever to be elected pope. And the church really hadn't elected a pope from a religious order since 1830s, so it's been quite some time. The Jesuit order was founded by St. Ignatius Loyola in 1540, and largely for the care of souls, with a focus on the intellect. Pope Francis grew out of that. He served, had a great love for the poor in his native Argentina, but rose to become Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And when he was elected pope and he came out, he had this very humble demeanor. And interestingly, he's also not an intellectual in the sense of a published academic. He had great academic preparation, but was not a published academic. So the first Jesuit, I think, is an opportunity to see the power of religious orders in the church, and also a voice from a different continent.
As a non-Catholic, I have come to think of the Jesuits as people who are willing to be engaged in public events, who have something to say about the news of the day or actions that relate to the news of the day. Is there some connection between that and the way that the Pope did speak out on very many current issues?
Yes, he's very much in, there's an old Latin expression, in media res, to assert oneself in the middle of things. He was very much in the middle of things. We often saw his commentary on contemporary issues when he was flying back from a country he visited, because he, like popes before him, went back to the press section of the plane and shared his thoughts on any number of issues. And some of the things that he said sometimes struck people, because was he speaking with the full authority of the church, or was he offering perhaps his opinion? And in many cases, it was both. And he did love to be engaged in the world, always, always a strident defender of the poor, the downtrodden, the marginalized, and the oppressed.
Because of that, he was seen as a liberal. That was a label that people on the outside would put on him. Did you see him that way?
Well, it's interesting because I think, as you noted earlier, he did not make any substantial changes to church doctrine. He did not, in a sense, the fundamental teachings of the church remained the same. But he always took a pastoral inclination. So he cared for the individual before him, and he always put the individual before him ahead of what the church might officially teach. And that led some of his critics to say, well, is he sowing confusion? Is he clouding the issue? He would say, no, I'm not clouding the issue. I'm showing that we always have to put the soul in front of us before our own certitude.
Oh, meaning that even if the person in front of him did not follow church teaching, he would deal with them as an individual, as a person.
Yeah, I think that is true. He once used the metaphor that the church should be a field hospital. And that was his approach, that, if someone has a serious wound, you're not going to talk about their cholesterol or other health monitored events, that the most important thing was dealing with the wound in front of them. And then he even likened his priests and bishops to take on the smell of the sheep, to really feel the pain people were carrying. So that was very much a part of his papacy.
In the few seconds that we have, I don't know that you ever got to see him in person or be close to him, but what was it like when he was around people?
He was he's very gregarious. I can remember one time I met him and I said I was a Jesuit, and he said back in Italian, "È la tua colpa," which means that's your fault. He had a very playful demeanor about him. Also, I remember once going to him when my father had cancer, and he grabbed me close and said, "I will pray for him." These kinds of things made him just emanate warmth, love, and compassion.
Father Tim Kosicki, thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
He's the former head of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States, speaking with us on this morning that we have learned that Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. This is NPR News.
The Vatican announced that Pope Francis has died. Originally from Argentina, he was the first non-European pope in more than 1,000 years. The pontiff was also one of the most popular church leaders in decades and a towering figure on the world stage. Stay with us for special coverage of his life and legacy on All Things Considered from NPR News. Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The world is mourning the death of Pope Francis. The Vatican announced today that he died at the age of 88. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports the Pope spent his final days in service of the Church.
The reason I say is stunning because in the last few days, Pope Francis had surprised many people by coming out, even though he was convalescing, but he made several appearances, surprise appearances, many of them. And just yesterday, just before the Easter Mass was celebrated in St. Peter's Square, he said just a few words, but the message to the city and the world, as it's known on Easter Day, was read out, and it was an extremely forceful one.
That's NPR Silvio Poggioli reporting from Rome. Pope Francis was known for his humility and progressive stance on social issues. Kim Daniels is the director of the Initiative on Catholic Social Thought and Public Life at Georgetown University. She says Francis redefined what it meant to be a modern-day pope.
He really had this program, this plan, this approach of spiritual renewal and structural reform. And in many ways, he has this church, our church, which is so rooted in tradition, but again, is forward-looking for the times that we are in today.
The Vatican says the pope's body will be laid in a coffin later today. A period of official mourning will follow. This is NPR News in Washington. Vice President J.D. Vance is visiting India. He and Prime Minister Narendra Modi are expected to discuss trade. Omkar Kandekar reports New Delhi is looking to avoid U.S. tariffs.
Vance is meeting with Modi to negotiate a potential trade deal and the purchase of U.S. defense equipment. The bilateral talks come weeks after President Trump imposed and paused a 27% tariff on India. The U.S. is India's biggest trade partner. India's foreign ministry said in February that the countries want to double their trade to $500 billion in the next 5 years. Modi was amongst the first few world leaders to meet with Trump in Washington after he returned to the White House for a second term. Second Lady Usha Vance, whose parents are from India, is also on the four-day visit, along with their children. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
The president of Ukraine is claiming Russia has violated its own ceasefire that the Kremlin declared for Easter. Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia fired dozens of shells and drone strikes on Ukraine. Russia's defense ministry says the Russian military observed the ceasefire and Ukrainian forces launched overnight attacks on their troops in eastern Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says fighting resumed after the ceasefire ended at midnight. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. On this morning of Pope Francis's death, our reporters and guests have emphasized something. The Pope did not really change the theology of a 2,000-year-old institution, but he tended to emphasize the individual rather than the rules.
And a big part of the Pope's image was his own individual story. He was born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Buenos Aires from an immigrant family. His father had come to Argentina from Italy. Pope Francis was the first non-European pope in more than a millennium and one of the most popular pontiffs in decades. When he was elected to his exalted post in 2013, he assumed the name of a saint, Francis of Assisi, who deliberately lived in poverty. Francis was also a strong advocate for the poor and the environment and a towering figure on the world stage, addressing not just Catholics, but also the men and women of our time. In one of his last public meetings, Francis met briefly with U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance yesterday to exchange Easter greetings. We will continue to follow the life and legacy of Pope Francis this morning and likely the rest of the week.
Fitting that he would meet with J.D. Vance on the last day of his life, because this was a pope who was deeply engaged in current affairs, who had something to say about news around the world, and in fact had an exchange with J.D. Vance over their respective beliefs of what the Catholic Church meant and what their Catholic faith meant. We have so much to say about that. We will continue to cover the Pope's death throughout this morning and throughout this week. We expect announcements of the funeral in days to come. But we're also keeping track of a lot of other news, because it was yet another remarkably busy weekend. And here's one item in the news. The Senate's top Democrat, Chuck Schumer, is calling again for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to be fired over a report of a chat in the Signal app. Now, if you weren't following news over the weekend, you may think, well, that's an old story from weeks ago, but actually it's happened again in the Signal app. A report that there was a chat in the Signal app started by Hegseth that discussed plans for the U.S. attack on Houthis in Yemen. NPR has not been able to independently confirm this report, which was first reported by the New York Times and appeared to be confirmed by the Defense Department, a second chat on the commercially available app. Unlike an earlier chat that became public when it inadvertently included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeff Goldberg, this conversation was started by the defense secretary himself. So let's discuss this with Jim Himes. He's a member of Congress, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, which looks into these matters. Congressman, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Do you have any independent reason to believe or disbelieve this report in the New York Times?
No, I'm like everyone else, just reading it in the media. But no, not shocking based on the pattern of behavior we've seen for a long time now out of the Pentagon.
Now, the statement from the Defense Department about this, this quoted in the Times, says, listen, nothing of all that important was discussed here. Nothing secret or classified was discussed here. Not that it was unimportant, but nothing classified was discussed here. If there, in fact, are, again, details of what was a forthcoming attack in Yemen, does that strike you as nothing classified, nothing secret, nothing that important?
No, I mean, it's simply not, right? I mean, this is sort of not subject to debate, right? What is classified is not at the discretion of the person who is generating the information. There's very clear standards for what needs to be classified. And in fact, when I had the opportunity to talk to Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, at an open hearing a number of weeks ago, I actually read her the standard. And, you know, preparations for an attack, and it's almost ridiculous to have to say this, but especially specific preparations for an attack, timing, weapon systems, et cetera, are to be classified top secret. And look, I think most Americans, even if they don't know the Pentagon standards for classification, understand that talking in advance in an unsecured spot, whether it's a Signal chat or a bar, about an upcoming attack could result in tragedy. And we're very, very fortunate that in this case it didn't.
What have you, and I guess we should note, according to the New York Times, his wife was on the chat. She has traveled around with him and attended meetings with him. Other people were on the chat who are in the Pentagon, but not necessarily in a position to need to know this information. Was anybody on that chat who strikes you as inappropriate?
Well, the whole thing is inappropriate, right? I mean, again, we spend millions and millions of dollars a year creating classified and sealed environments in which this stuff is talked about. No, I can't imagine why his wife, his brother, and his personal lawyer would need to know particular aircraft that are to be used in an upcoming attack. So, I mean, this is just sadly reflective of a much larger problem at the Pentagon here. I mean, it's important to remember the context, right? All cabinet secretaries have difficult jobs, but the defense secretary's job is unique because 24/7, the hundreds of thousands of people of the Department of Defense are doing things like driving aircraft carriers and launching planes off of these carriers and carrying weapons and doing lethal things. And, 24/7, the Secretary of Defense must be almost perfect in their prudence, in their care, in their ability to make judgments when really awful things are happening. And when you see basic errors, including your wife and your brother on a what should be illegal communication about an upcoming attack, you really need to worry about the national security of the country as a whole.
Isn't it true, though, and you would know this as the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, that a lot of people in the U.S. government find Signal to be pretty good, and in fact, people in the CIA have it installed on their computers?
Well, so Signal is pretty good. That's exactly the right word, but I'm here to tell you that it's not perfect. And so, yes, people in the government use Signal for unimportant, by the way, as do I, for unimportant things, to communicate social plans to my colleagues, for example. But there's two problems. Number one, it's not perfect. And there is this whole other system that we spend tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money to handle precisely these communications. And number two, though it's a little esoteric, the government is required, and people in senior positions in government are required to keep a record of their communications, which of course in Signal is almost impossible to do. This was, of course, takes us back to, you know, the absolute outrage that we dealt with for half a decade over Hillary Clinton's emails. One of the charges was that she was breaking the law on records preservation. That's secondary to the very serious danger that the Secretary of Defense and Mike Waltz put our pilots in, but it is a thing.
Just about 20 seconds left, but what do you make of this? Apparently, even as this story was unfolding, the Defense Department was dismissing senior advisors to Hegseth for supposedly leaking information, something they've denied. But these very people were on the very same Signal chat that Hegseth himself initiated.
Yeah, and look, it's totally, we have no idea what's going on other than the fact that the most senior advisors to the Secretary of Defense were fired. We also know that a four-star general who ran the National Security Agency, a military officer, was fired because Laura Loomer had a problem with him. This is a pattern of real trouble at the top of our most dangerous government department.
Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One disclosure, NPR's CEO chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation. We'll continue to cover this story like any other. And this is NPR News.
The Vatican has announced that Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. Stay with us for special coverage of his life and legacy on Here and Now from NPR News.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. People who talk about the legacy of Pope Francis will surely mention his theology, but let's not forget his work as a nightclub bouncer. Early in his papacy, the man famous for his humility talked of odd jobs he'd worked early in life. He swept floors as a janitor. He worked in a chemical lab. He taught high school. And yes, he was a bouncer, a job that calls upon you to turn someone's other cheek right out into the street. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Throughout this Monday morning, we are covering Pope Francis, who appeared before crowds on Easter Sunday, hours before his death, according to the Vatican, at the age of 88. We're also keeping up on other news, including a supposed Easter truce in the war on Ukraine. Russia declared that truce, and then both Russia and Ukraine accused the other of violating it. Over the weekend, we also had news of the effort to bring peace in Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Ukrainian officials and came away saying that if a deal doesn't seem possible soon, the United States will move on. NPR's Joanna Kakitsis is covering all of this. Joanna, welcome.
Hello.
How did Ukrainians respond to the U.S., I guess threat is the word, or statement that they can walk away?
So most Ukrainians I've been speaking to say there is much more uncertainty now about Ukraine's fate. I just got back last night from the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy, which is about 16 miles from the Russian border. Russian forces repeatedly strike Sumy. So a little over a week ago on Palm Sunday, Russia hit the city's downtown with two ballistic missiles. They killed 35 people, injured more than 100. And I spoke to a music college administrator, Nadia Hrin, who lost a very close friend in that Palm Sunday attack.
The horror and cruelty, we feel it every day. We tell ourselves that we will get through this. Yet every night we say, have a safe day, have a safe night, a quiet evening. That's something we never did before.
Ukrainians here also told me that it seems Russian President Vladimir Putin is controlling the direction of peace talks and that the Trump administration seems more interested in striking business deals with Moscow and not in working toward a durable peace deal with terms that are fair to Ukraine.
Okay, so that's what Ukrainians, some of them anyway, are saying that they perceive. Secretary of State Marco Rubio made this statement after meeting with Ukrainians. The next step is to take whatever peace proposal they have to the Russians. What do the Ukrainians you talk with see as fair terms here?
So the main ones include refusing to recognize the Ukrainian territory occupied by Russian troops as belonging to Russia, getting back all prisoners of war and thousands of Ukrainian children abducted by Russia, and providing security guarantees. This one's key, so Russia does not invade Ukraine again. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says these terms, and especially anything to do about territory, that cannot be discussed seriously until there is a durable ceasefire first.
Now, that's very interesting because it seems likely, and the Trump administration has leaned toward the idea that you would have a ceasefire along the current battle lines, which means the Russians would get to keep some territory even if it was not formally recognized as Russian.
That's right.
But you mentioned the ceasefire would have to come first, according to Zelensky. Has the United States been able to enforce or get the Russians to stand behind a durable as opposed to a temporary ceasefire?
Well, as you know, Ukraine agreed to a U.S.-brokered 30-day ceasefire unconditionally about a month ago. Russia never signed on and eventually escalated attacks on Ukraine. And then it was this weekend that Putin declared his own truce, and it's one that's already ended.
Okay, so then there's the question of what happens if peace talks don't go anywhere. Are the Ukrainians prepared to endure without as much support or any support from the United States if they had to?
Well, look, Steve, Zelensky has said repeatedly that losing the U.S. as a partner and peace broker would be devastating, and Ukraine needs military aid to keep defending itself from Russia. So what he's been doing is strengthening ties with the Europeans who still consider Russia a threat to international security.
Joanna Kakitsis in Kyiv, thanks so much. This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Pope Francis died today. He was 88 years old, the first non-European pope in more than a millennium. He was one of the most popular pontiffs in decades and a towering figure on the world stage, addressing not just Catholics, but the men and women of our time. Here's NPR's Silvia Pujoli.
Jorge Bergoglio was born in Buenos Aires. The son of Italian immigrants was proud of his Argentine heritage.
The tangueros.
On his 78th birthday, Francis welcomed hundreds of couples as they danced the tango in St. Peter's Square. He clearly appreciated the gift. After all, before becoming a priest, he'd worked as a nightclub bouncer. He was beloved for his common touch, wading into crowds, kissing babies, the disabled, and the disfigured. Oblivious to his AIDS security fears, he refused to ride in a bulletproof popemobile. Bergoglio set many precedents. The first Jesuit pope, the first pope to take the name of St. Francis of Assisi, and the first pope from the global south. On his election in 2013, after the surprise resignation of Benedict XVI, he broke with tradition, opting to live in a Vatican hotel rather than the opulent papal quarters. By rejecting the monarchical trappings of the papacy, says Associated Press reporter Nicole Winfield, Francis made a powerful statement.
I'm going to live with regular people. I'm going to get up in the morning and go to the dining hall and have my breakfast. At dinner time, I'm going to line up with everyone else, cafeteria style, and get my dinner. I'm going to microwave my dinner when it's not warm enough. Yes, he nuked his own food.
As Archbishop of Buenos Aires, a megalopolis with huge gaps between rich and poor, Bergoglio had stayed close to his flock in the shantytowns. Church historian Massimo Fagioli says that's why the dispossessed on the peripheries of society became the focus of his papacy.
Most popes before Francis had no occasions to meet with the outcasts. And that's something that got to real people, even beyond the Catholic Church.
The first papal trip was to Lampedusa, the island gateway to Europe for hundreds of thousands of migrants fleeing war and poverty. There he denounced the globalization of indifference toward migrants. Weeks later, in his first airborne news conference, Francis uttered a phrase that would define his papacy as inclusive.
If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?
In a long interview with Father Antonio Spadaro, Francis outlined his vision of the Catholic Church as a field hospital after battle, healing the wounds of the faithful and going out to find those who have been hurt, excluded, or fallen away. Father Spadaro.
That was not just a nice image for talking about the church. Church is not sometimes a field hospital, but the church is a field hospital to save the people, not just to cure some little problems, but the complete openness of the church toward the world.
Francis cleaned up Vatican finances, long tainted by corruption. He created a kitchen cabinet of nine cardinals to help reform a dysfunctional bureaucracy. After exhibiting at first what some Vatican observers deemed a blind spot toward clerical pedophilia, Francis appealed to the faithful to help root out what he called the culture of death and convened an extraordinary sex abuse summit at the Vatican. And after the two conservative papacies of John Paul and Benedict focused on the primacy of church doctrine, Francis announced a year-long jubilee on the primacy of mercy.
Nessuno può essere escluso dalla misericordia di Dio.
No one can be excluded from the mercy of God. The church is the house that welcomes all and refuses no one.
As a young man, he studied chemistry before entering the priesthood as a Jesuit. In the 1970s, Bergoglio lived through the repression of Argentina's military junta. Elisabetta Piquet is an Argentine journalist and biographer of Bergoglio, whom she knew well. He firmly rejected the leftist ideology behind liberation theology, says Piquet, and focused on a Latin American grassroots religiosity.
He followed the la teología del pueblo, the theology of the people, that was a kind of readaptation of the theology of liberation, but without It's Marxist ideology.
But Francis was not afraid to criticize Western powers. In a sweeping document on the environment, he blamed humans for having turned the earth into what he called an immense pile of filth. In one of his most blistering speeches, he said that behind the harm being done to the environment is what he called the dung of the devil, the unfettered pursuit of money.
Once capital becomes an idol and guides people's decisions, once greed for money presides over the entire socioeconomic system, it ruins society. It sets people against one another. It even puts at risk our common home, our sister, Mother Earth.
Francis' staunch environmentalism and critique of laissez-faire capitalism met with vehement opposition from conservatives within and outside the Catholic Church. His most vocal antagonists were traditionalist American Catholics who attacked the Pope in tweets, blogs, and conservative media. Before his election, Bergoglio had traveled very little. As Francis, he became a global player, preferring to visit what he called the peripheries of the world in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. He helped restore relations between the U.S. and Cuba. And Francis had no qualms in delivering overtly political messages. Accepting a prestigious European prize, he sharply scolded the European Union for its treatment of migrants and fraying sense of unity.
I dream of a Europe that is still young, that cares for children and offers fraternal help to the poor. I dream of a Europe that promotes and protects the rights of everyone. And I dream of a Europe where being a migrant is not a crime.
Church historian Massimo Fagioli says the world was fascinated by how Francis transformed the epitome of conservatism.
The leader of a very conservative institution who tries to change it radically from the top. That's revolutionary.
A master at blending the spiritual and the political, Francis emerged as a daring, independent broker on the global stage. His papacy, inclusive and welcoming, re-energized the Catholic Church and brought it into the 21st century. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Stevens.
Until they're through.